than 3 minutes with Kelly. Charlie said, Lyman's been here about 12 years. He's retired up from Marietta. He's a super hard ass about procedure. Do you have a dress or a skirt in your suitcase? Whatever for. Doesn't matter.
Sure it doesn't.
Mo put down the phone. She told Sam, you've got 17 minutes left. Grell drank away 3. You'll have to talk to her in the cell. Charlie slammed her fist on the counter.
What the fuck, Mo?
Charlie, I've got this. Sam addressed Mo. If the room isn't available now, then you should inform the judge that we need to postpone the hearing until I have the necessary time to confer privately with my client. Mo grunted. She glared at Sam, waiting for her to back down. When she did not, the woman said,
I thought you were supposed to be the smart one.
She reached under her desk and pressed a buzzer. She winked at Sam.
Room's on the ride. 16 minutes.
Charlie pumped her fist in the air, then sprinted toward the stairs. She was so light on her feet that she barely made a sound. Sam moved her purse to her other shoulder. She leaned on her cane as she dragged through the door. She stopped in front of another door, effectively boxed in as the first door behind her closed. Another buzz, and the second door swung open in front of her. Sam was besieged by the long-forgotten odors of a holding cell. Putrid vomit, mixed with an alkaline sweat. The ammonia of urine. The sewage stench from the one toilet that serviced roughly 100 inmates a day. Sam pushed herself off with her cane. Her shoes slapped brown puddles of water. No one had cleaned up the flooded toilet. There was only one inmate left in the holding cell, an older, toothless woman who was squatting on a long concrete bench. Her orange jumper bulked around her like a blanket. She moved slowly back and forth between her feet. Her rheumy eyes followed Sam as she walked toward the closed door on the right. The knob turned before Sam could knock. The female deputy who came out looked burly and brusque. She closed the door, her back pressed to the opaque glass.
You the second lawyer?
Third, technically, Samantha Quinn.
Rusty's oldest.
Sam nodded, though she hadn't been asked a question.
The inmate has puked approximately 4 times over the last half hour. I gave her a pack of orange crackers and 1 can of Coke, served in a styrofoam cup. I asked if she wanted medical attention. She declined. You've got 15 minutes before I come back in.
She tapped the watch on her wrist.
Whatever I hear when I come in is what I hear. You got me?
Sam took out her phone. She set the timer for 14 minutes.
I'm glad we understand each other.
The woman opened the door. The room was so dark that Sam's eyes could only slowly adjust. 2 chairs, a metal table bolted to the floor, a flickering fluorescent light hanging crookedly from 2 furred lengths of chain. Kelly Renee Wilson was slumped over the table. Her head was wrapped in the cocoon of her folded arms. When the door opened, she jumped up to standing, arms at her sides, shoulders straight, as if Sam had called a soldier to attention. Sam said, "You can sit down." Kelly waited for Sam to sit first. Sam took the empty chair by the door. She rested her cane against the table. She reached into her purse for her notepad and pen. She changed out her glasses for her readers. "My name is Samantha Quinn. I'm your lawyer for the arraignment. You met my father, Rusty, yesterday."
Kelly said, "You talk funny."
Sam smiled. She sounded Southern to New Yorkers, and she sounded like a Yankee to Southerners. "I live in New York City."
"Because you're crippled?"
Sam almost laughed. "No, I live in New York because I like it. I use a cane when my leg gets tired."
"My granddaddy had a cane, but it was wood."
The girl seemed matter-of-fact, but the clink-clink sound from her handcuffs indicated she was nervously bouncing her leg. Sam said, "You don't have to be afraid, Kelly. I'm your ally. I'm not here to trip you up." She wrote Kelly's name and the date at the top of her notepad. She underlined the words twice. She felt the odd sensation of butterflies in her stomach.
"Did you speak with Mr. Grail, the attorney who came to see you earlier?"
"Oh, ma'am. On account of I was sick."
Sam studied the girl. She spoke slowly, almost as if she was drugged. Judging by the S on the front of her orange jumper, they had given her an adult small, but the uniform was voluminous on her petite frame. Kelly looked wan. Her hair was greasy, speckled with pieces of vomit. As thin as she was, her face was round, angelic. Sam reminded herself that Lucy Alexander's face had been angelic, too. She asked Kelly, "Are you on any medication?"
"They give me liquids at the hospital yesterday."
She showed Sam the bruised red dot near the crook of her right arm.
"Through here."
Sam transcribed the exact words. Rusty would need to get the girl's hospital records. "You think they gave you fluids but no medication?"
"Yes, ma'am. That's what I was told, on account of being shocked."
"In shock?" Sam clarified. The girl nodded.
"Yes, ma'am."
"You're not currently on or have not taken any illegal drugs?"
"Illegal drugs?"
the girl asked.
"No, ma'am. That wouldn't be right."
Again, Sam copied her words. "And how are you feeling now?"
"Okay, I guess. Not so poorly as before."
Sam looked at Kelly Wilson over the top of her reading glasses. The girl's hands were still clasped under the table, shoulders rolled in, making her look even smaller. Sam could see the red of the plastic chair peeking out on either side of the girl's back. "Are you okay, or are you okay, you guess?" Kelly said,
"I'm pretty scared. There's some mean people here."
"Your best strategy is to ignore them." Sam jotted down some general notes about Kelly's appearance, that she looked unwashed, unkempt. Her fingernails were chewed down. Her cuticles showed dried blood. "How's your stomach now?"
"It's just a little upset this time of day."
"This time of day?" Sam made a notation and wrote down the time. "Were you sick yesterday?"
"Yes, ma'am, but I didn't tell nobody. When I get like that, it usually calms down on its own, but that lady out there was nice and gave me some crackers."
Sam kept her gaze on her notepad. She did not want to look at Kelly because she felt an unwelcoming softening each time she did. The girl did not fit the image of a murderer, let alone a school shooter. Then again, perhaps Sam's past experiences with Zachariah and Daniel Culpepper had framed the wrong image in her mind. The fact was that anybody could kill. She told Kelly, "I'm working with my father, Rusty Quinn, until he's feeling better. Did someone tell you that he's in the hospital?"
"Yes, ma'am. Them guards back at the jail were talking about it. How Mr. Rusty got stabbed."
Sam doubted the guards had anything good to say about Rusty. "So did Mr. Rusty tell you that he works for you, not your parents, and that anything you say to him is private?"
"It's the law," she said. "Mr. Rusty can't tell nobody what I say."
"That's correct," Sam said. "And it's the same with me. We both took an oath of confidentiality. You can talk to me, and I can talk to Mr. Rusty about the things you tell me, but we can't tell anyone else your secrets."
"Is that hard, knowing everybody's secrets like that?"
Sam felt disarmed by the question.
"It can be, but
that's part of my job requirement, and I knew that I would have to keep secrets when I decided to become a lawyer."
"You gotta go to school for a lot of years to do that."
"I did." Sam looked at her phone. She normally charged by the hour. She was not accustomed to abbreviating her time. "Did Mr. Rusty explain to you what an arraignment is?"
"It ain't a trial."
"That's right." Sam realized that she was modulating her voice as if she was addressing a child. This girl was 18, not 8. Lucy Alexander had been 8 years old. Sam cleared her throat. She explained, "In most cases, the law requires an arraignment to take place within 48 hours of an arrest. Basically, this is when a case goes from being an investigation to a criminal case in court. There is a formal reading of a criminal charge or indictment in the presence of the defendant to inform the defendant, you, of the pending charges that have been filed against you, and afford you the opportunity to enter an initial plea into the record.
I know that sounds like a lot, but soup to nuts, the entire process should take less than 10 minutes.
Kelly blinked.
Do you understand what I just told you?
You talk really fast.
Sam had worked hundreds of hours to normalize her speech, and now she had to concentrate in order to slow it down. She tried.
During the arraignment, there won't be any police officers or witnesses called. Okay?
Kelly nodded.
No evidence will be presented. Your guilt or innocence will not be assessed or determined.
Kelly waited.
The judge will ask for your plea to be entered into the record. I will tell him your plea, which is not guilty. You can amend that later if you so desire.
Sam paused. She had started to rev up again.
Then the judge, the prosecutor, and I will discuss dates and motions and other business of the court. I will request those matters be taken up when my father, Mr. Rusty, has recovered, which will likely be within the next week. You need not speak during any part of this process. I will speak for you. Do you understand?
Kelly said,
Your daddy told me not to talk to nobody, and I ain't. Not unless it was the guards and telling them I was feeling sick.
Her shoulders rolled farther inward.
It was nice, though, like I said. Everybody's been treating me real nice here.
Except for some of the mean ones?
Yes, ma'am. There's been some mean ones.
Sam looked down at her notes. Rusty had been right. Kelly was too agreeable. She did not seem to understand the depth of trouble that she was in. The girl would have to be evaluated for mental competency. Sam was certain she could locate someone in New York who was willing to work pro bono.
Miss Quinn,
Kelly asked,
can I ask, do my mama and daddy know I'm in here?
Yes.
Sam realized Kelly had been left in the dark for the last 24 hours. Your parents weren't allowed to visit you in the jail until after the arraignment, but they are both very eager to see you.
Are they mad about what happened?
They're worried about you.
Sam could only go on assumptions. They love you very much, though. You'll all get through this together, no matter what.
Kelly's lip quivered. Tears fell from her eyes.
I love them, too.
Sam sat back in her chair. She reminded herself of Douglas Pinkman, the way he had cheered for her at every track meet, even after she had moved up to high school. The man had been to more of Sam's events than her own father. And now, Sam was sitting across from the girl who had murdered him. She told Kelly, Your parents will be in the courtroom upstairs, but you aren't going to be able to touch them or talk to them other than to say hello. Sam hoped there were no cameras in the courtroom. She would have to make sure Kelly's parents were forewarned. Once you're transferred back to the jail, you'll be able to visit with them, but remember, anything you say to your parents or anyone else while you are in the jail will be recorded. Whether it's in the visitation room or on the telephone, someone is always listening. Don't talk to them about what happened yesterday, okay?
Yes, ma'am. But can I ask, am I in trouble?
Sam studied her face for signs of guile.
Kelly, do you remember what happened yesterday morning? Yes, ma'am. I killed them two people. The gun was in my hand.
Sam considered her affect, looking for signs of remorse. There was none. Kelly might as well have been describing events that had happened to someone else. Sam thought about how to pose the question. Did you know Lucy Alexander?
No, ma'am. I think she must have been at the elementary school, 'cause she looked real little.
Sam opened her mouth and drew in some air. How about Mr. Pinkman?
Well, I heard people say he wasn't a bad man, but I never got sent to the principal's office.
The randomness of the victim somehow made it worse.
So, they both, Mr. Pinkman and Lucy Alexander just happened to be in the hallway at the wrong time?
I guess, Kelly answered. Like I said, the gun was in my hand, and then Mr. Huckabee put it down his pants.
Sam felt her heart shake inside of her chest. She looked at the timer on her phone. She made sure there was no shadow lingering at the door. She asked Kelly, "Did you tell my father what you just told me?"
"No, ma'am. I didn't say much to your daddy yesterday. I was upset 'cause they had me at the hospital, and plus my tummy was hurting like it does, and they were talking about keeping me overnight, and I know that costs a lot of money to be there."
Sam closed her notepad. She capped her pen. She exchanged her readers for her regular glasses. She was in a somewhat unique situation. A defense lawyer was not allowed to put a witness on the stand knowing that the witness was going to lie. This rule explained why attorneys never wanted their clients to tell them the whole truth. The whole truth seldom made for a good defense. Everything Kelly told Sam would be held in confidence. But Sam would never call or cross-examine a witness, so she would not have her hands tied. She could simply edit out the damaging facts when she relayed this conversation to Rusty and let him take care of the rest. Kelly said,
"My Uncle Shane passed in the hospital, and his wife and them had to move out of their house 'cause the bills were too much."
"They won't charge you for the hospital stay." She smiled. Her teeth were tiny white beads.
"Do my parents know that? Because I think that'll come as a relief."
"I'll make sure they know."
"Thank you, Miss Quinn. I sure do appreciate all you and your daddy done for me."
Sam rolled the pen between her fingers. She remembered something from the news last night. "Do you know if the middle school has security cameras?"
"Yes, ma'am. They got one in each of the halls, except the one by the front office got hit, and it don't get hardly anything past a certain point."
"It has a blind spot?"
"I don't know that it's got that, but it can't see everything past somewhere about the middle of the hall."
"How do you know it can't?" She raised her thin shoulders up, then held them for a second before letting them drop back down.
"It's just something everybody knows."
Sam asked, "Kelly, do you have many friends at school?"
"Acquaintances, you mean?"
Sam nodded. "Sure."
"I guess I know almost about everybody. I've been at the school a real long time."
She smiled again.
"Not long enough to be a lawyer, though."
Sam felt herself smile back. "Do you have anyone you're particularly close to?" Kelly's cheeks turned bright red. Sam recognized that type of blush. She opened her notepad. "You can tell me his name. I won't repeat it to anyone."
"Adam Humphrey."
Kelly was obviously eager to talk about the boy.
"He's got brown hair and eyes, and he's not real tall, but he drives a Camaro. But we don't go together, not like official or anything."
"Okay. How about friends who are girls? Do you have any of those?"
"No, ma'am. Not close like I'd bring 'em home with me."
She remembered.
"Except there was Lydia Phillips when I was in elementary school. Only she moved away when her daddy got transferred on account of the economy."
Sam recorded the details in her pad. "Are there teachers you're close to?"
"Well, Mr. Huckabee used to help me with my history lessons, but he ain't done that in a while. Dr. Jody said he'd let me do some extra work to make up for missing some classes last week, but he ain't given me that work yet. And Mrs. Pinkman's..."
Kelly quickly bowed her head. Sam finished a line in her notes. She put down her pen. She studied the girl. Kelly had gone still. Sam asked, "Was Mrs. Pinkman helping you with English?" Kelly did not answer. She kept her head down. Her hair covered her face. Sam could hear her sniff. Her shoulders began to shake. She was crying. "Kelly," Sam said, "why are you upset?"
"'Cause Mr. Pinkman wasn't a bad man,"
she sniffed again.
And that girl was just a baby.
Sam clasped her hands together. She leaned her elbows on the table. Why were you at the middle school yesterday morning?
Because,
she mumbled. Because why?
Because I brung the gun from my daddy's glove box,
she sniffed.
And I had it in my hand when I killed them two people.
The prosecutor and Sam wanted to press, but she wasn't here to break the girl. Kelly, I know you're probably tired of hearing me say this, but it's important. You are never to tell anyone what you just told me, okay? Not your parents, not friends, not strangers, especially not anyone you meet in jail.
They ain't my friends, is what Mr. Rusty said.
Kelly's voice was muffled behind the cascade of thick hair.
They might try to get me in trouble so they can get out of trouble themselves.
That's right. No one you meet in here is your friend, not the guards or your fellow inmates or the janitor or anyone else. The girl sniffed. The handcuff chain was clinking under the table again.
I ain't talked to none of them. I just kept to myself like I do.
Sam pulled the rest of the tissues from her purse and passed them to Kelly. I'll speak with your parents before you see them and make sure they know not to ask you about what happened. Sam assumed that Rusty had given the Wilsons that speech already, but they were going to hear it from Sam before she left town. Everything you told me about yesterday is between you and me, okay? She sniffed again.
Okay.
Blow your nose. She waited for Kelly to do as she was told, then said, Tell me about Adam Humphrey. Did you meet him in school? Kelly shook her head. Sam could still not see her face. All she saw was the top of her head. Sam asked, Did you meet Adam when you were out, for instance, at a movie or at church? Kelly shook her head again. Tell me about the yearbook in your closet. Kelly quickly looked up. Sam expected to see anger, but she saw fear.
Please don't tell nobody.
I won't, Sam promised. Remember, everything here is confidential. Kelly kept the tissue in her hand as she wiped her nose with her sleeve. Sam asked, Can you tell me why people wrote those things about you?
They were bad things.
I don't think the acts they were describing were bad. I think that the people who wrote those things were being unkind. Kelly appeared baffled. Sam couldn't fault her. This was no time to lecture an 18-year-old spree killer on feminism. She asked Kelly, Why did they write those things about you?
I don't know, ma'am. You'd have to ask them.
Were some of the things they said true? Kelly looked back down at the table.
Not like how they said, but... Maybe something similar.
Sam wondered at the turn of phrase. The girl was not so slow that she couldn't obfuscate. Were you angry because they were picking on you?
No,
she said.
I was hurt mostly because them's private things, and I didn't know most of them people, but I guess it was a long time ago. A lot of them could have graduated already.
Has your mother seen the yearbook? Kelly's eyes went wide. This time she looked scared.
Please don't show my mama.
I won't, Sam promised. Remember how I told you that anything you tell me will remain confidential?
No.
Sam felt a prick in her left eyebrow. When I first walked into the room, I explained to you who I am and that I work with my father, and that we have both taken an oath of confidentiality.
No, ma'am, I don't remember that last part.
Confidentiality means that I have to keep your secrets.
Oh, well, okay. That's what your daddy said, too, about secrets.
Sam looked at the time. She had less than 4 minutes. Kelly, I was told that yesterday morning, right after the shooting took place, when Mr. Huckabee was asking you to relinquish the revolver, you said something that Mr. Huckabee and... Perhaps a police officer heard. Do you remember what you said?
No, ma'am. I didn't much feel like talking after that.
You said something, Sam tried again. The officer heard you. Mr. Huckabee heard you.
Okay.
Kelly nodded slowly.
I did say something.
Sam was surprised by how quickly the girl had changed her story. Do you remember what you said?
I don't know. I don't remember saying it.
Sam felt Kelly's eagerness to please pushing out into the space between them. She tried approaching the question from a different angle, asking, Kelly, in the hallway yesterday morning, did you tell Mr. Huckabee and the police officer that the lockers are blue?
Yes, ma'am.
Kelly latched onto the suggestion.
They are blue.
Sam started nodding her head. I know they're blue. But is that what you said at that point? Did you actually say that to them, that the lockers are blue? Is that what you told Mr. Huckabee and the policeman, that the lockers are blue? Kelly began nodding along.
Yes, I said that.
Sam knew the girl was lying. At that moment in time yesterday morning, Kelly Wilson had just shot and killed two people. Her former teacher was asking her to hand over the murder weapon. A policeman was undoubtedly pointing a gun at her head. Kelly had not stopped to note the school decor. Sam asked, "You remember telling both of them that the lockers are blue?"
"Yes, ma'am."
Kelly seemed so certain of the answer that she likely would have passed a lie detector exam. "Okay." "So Mr. Huckabee was there," Sam said, wondering how far she could push the girl. "Mrs. Pinkman was there, too. Was anyone else there? Someone you didn't recognize?"
"There was a woman in a devil shirt."
She indicated her chest.
"The devil was wearing a blue mask, and it said the word devils on it."
Sam could still remember packing Charlie's things after her disastrous New York visit. Every T-shirt Charlie owned had some variation of the Duke Blue Devils logo. Sam asked Kelly, "The woman in the devil's shirt, did she hurt anybody?"
"No, ma'am. She was sitting there across from Mrs. Pinkman looking at her hands."
"Are you sure she didn't hurt anybody?" Sam made her voice firm. "This is very important, Kelly. You need to tell me if the woman in the devil's shirt hurt anyone."
"Well..."
Kelly studied Sam's face, looking for cues.
"I don't know if she did, on account of I was sitting."
Very slowly, Sam began to nod again. "I think you saw the devil's woman hurt someone, even though you were sitting down. The evidence shows that you saw her, Kelly. There's no point in lying." Kelly's uncertainty returned.
"I don't mean to lie to you. I know you're trying to help me."
Sam made her voice firm. "Then admit the truth. You saw the woman in the devil's shirt hurt someone."
"Yes, ma'am."
Kelly nodded, too.
"Now that I think on it, maybe she hurt somebody."
"Did she hurt you?" Kelly hesitated. She searched Sam's expression for guidance.
"Maybe."
"I can't use maybe to help you, Kelly." Sam tried again, declaring, "You saw the woman in the blue devil shirt hurt someone else who was in the hallway."
"Yes, ma'am."
Kelly seemed more sure of herself now. She kept nodding her head as if the motion informed her thinking.
"That's what I saw."
Sam asked, "Did the devil's woman hurt Mrs. Pinkman?" She leaned forward. "Because Mrs. Pinkman was right there, Kelly. You told me as much not a few seconds ago. Do you think the devil's woman could have hurt Mrs. Pinkman?"
"I think so."
Kelly continued to nod, because that was part of the pattern. She denied the statement, then she allowed that the statement might be true, then she accepted the statement as fact. All that Sam had to do was speak authoritatively, tell the girl the answer, nod a few times, then wait for the lie to be regurgitated back to her. Sam said, "According to eyewitnesses, Kelly, you saw exactly what the devil's woman did."
"Okay,"
Kelly said.
"That's what I seen happen, that she hurt her."
"How did the devil's woman hurt Mrs. Pinkman?" Sam waved her hands in the air, trying to think of examples.
Did she kick her? Did she punch her?
She slapped her with her hand.
Sam looked at the hand she had waved in the air, certain the motion had put the idea in Kelly's head.
You're sure you saw the devil's woman slap Mrs. Pinkman?
Yes, ma'am, it happened like you said. She slapped her across the face, and I could hear the noise all the way to where I was sitting in the hall.
Sam realized the enormity of the lie. Without thinking, she had implicated her own sister in assault.
So, what you're saying is that you saw with your own eyes when the devil's woman slapped Mrs. Pinkman across the face?
Pelly continued to nod. There were tears in her eyes. She clearly wanted to please Sam, as if pleasing her would somehow unlock the secret to getting her out of this living nightmare.
Kelly whispered,
I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Sam didn't push her further, because the exercise had proven her point. Given the right kind of leading question, the right tone, Kelly Wilson probably would have said Charlie murdered Judith Pinkman with her own hands.
The girl was so suggestible. She could have been hypnotized.
Sam checked her phone. 90 seconds remained, plus the 1-minute buffer. Did the police talk to you yesterday before Mr. Rusty did?
Yes, ma'am. They talked to me at the hospital.
Did they read you your Miranda rights before they spoke with you? Sam could tell she did not understand.
Did they say, you have the right to remain silent, you have the right to counsel? Did they say any of that to you?
No, ma'am. Not in the hospital, because I would have remembered that from the TV.
Sam leaned across the table again. Kelly, this is very important. Did you say anything to the police before you talked to my father?
This one older fella, he kept talking to me. He rode with me in the ambulance to the hospital, and then he stayed in my room to make sure I was okay.
Sam doubted the man was concerned about her well-being. Did you answer any of his questions? Did he interrogate you?
I don't know.
Were you handcuffed when he talked to you?
I ain't sure. In the ambulance, you mean?
Yes.
Well, no. Not then, not that I remember.
Do you remember exactly when you were handcuffed?
It was at some point.
Sam wanted to throw her pen across the room. Kelly, it's very important that you try to remember. Did they interrogate you at the hospital before my father told you not to answer any questions?
I'm sorry, ma'am. I don't remember much from yesterday.
But the older feller was always with you.
Yes, ma'am. Except when he had to go to the bathroom and then a police officer came and sat with me.
Was the older fella in a police uniform?
No, ma'am. He was in a suit and tie.
Did he tell you his name?
No, ma'am.
Do you remember when you were told your Miranda... When they said, you have a right to remain silent, you have a right to counsel? She waited. Kelly, do you remember when you were told those words? Kelly could clearly see this was important.
Maybe in the police car on the way to the jail this morning?
But it wasn't at the hospital.
No, ma'am. It was sometime this morning, but I don't know what time exactly.
Sam sat back in the chair. She tried to think this through. If Kelly had not been read her Miranda rights until this morning, then anything she said before that time could technically be inadmissible in court. Are you sure this morning was the first time they told you your rights?
Well, I know this morning it was the older fella that done it.
She shrugged her thin shoulders.
Maybe if he did it before... You can see it on the videotape.
What videotape?
The one they made of me at the hospital.
Chapter 11. Sam sat alone at the defense table. Her purse was on the floor. Her cane was folded up inside.
She studied her notes from the interview with Kelly Wilson, pretending as if she did not know that at least 100 people were sitting behind her. Without question, the majority of the spectators were locals. The heat of their white-hot rage made sweat roll down her back. One of them could be the person who had stabbed Rusty. Judging by the furious whispering, Sam gathered that many of them would gladly stab her, too. Ken Coyne coughed into his hand. The county prosecutor was sitting with a veritable phalanx, a doughy, fresh-faced second chair, an older man with a brush-broom mustache, and the obligatory attractive young blonde woman. In New York, this type of woman would be wearing a well-cut suit and expensive heels. The Pikeville version had her looking more like a Catholic nun. Ken coughed again. He wanted Sam to look at him, but she would not. A perfunctory handshake was all that she had allowed. Any gratitude that Coyne believed was owed to him for killing Daniel Culpepper had been erased by his scurrilous behavior. Sam was not a resident of Pikeville. She would never return. There was no need to pretend she had any affinity for the dirty, underhanded bastard. Coyne was the type of prosecutor who made all prosecutors look bad. Not only because of the cat and mouse he had played with the arraignment, but because of the videotape that had been made at the hospital. Whatever was on the recording could hang Kelly Wilson. There was no telling what the girl had said. Based on Sam's brief time with her, she did not doubt that Kelly Wilson could be talked into admitting that she had assassinated Abraham Lincoln. The legal issue, perhaps the most important motion that Rusty would argue, would be whether or not the film of Kelly should be admissible in court. If Kelly had not been read her Miranda rights before she answered questions on the record, or if it was clear that she did not understand her rights, then the video should not be shown to the jury. Technically, that was how it was supposed to work. But this was a legal matter. There were always workarounds. Ken Coyne would argue that Miranda did not matter because Kelly had voluntarily made the recorded statements. There was one giant legal hurdle in his way. In order for the video to be admissible, Coyne had to prove that a reasonable person, fortunately not Kelly Wilson herself, would assume that Kelly was not in police custody when the statements were recorded. If Kelly believed that she was under arrest, that handcuffs and fingerprints, impressions and a mugshot were imminent, then she was entitled to the reading of her rights. Ergo, no Miranda rights, no film shown to the jury. At least, that was how it was supposed to work. There were other weak links in the system, including the mood of the judge. Very rarely did you find a completely impartial figure on the bench. They tended to lean toward the prosecution or the defense. No judge liked to be appealed, but as a case moved higher up the chain, it became increasingly more difficult for a defendant to argue that a mistake had been made. No judge liked to reverse a lower judge. Sam closed her notepad. She glanced behind her. The Wilsons sat with Lenore. Sam had talked with them for less than 5 minutes before the general public was allowed into the courtroom. Cameras clicked as photographers caught Sam making eye contact with the killer's parents. Video cameras seemed to be banned from the courtroom, but there were plenty of reporters recording every moment with their pens. This was not the appropriate setting for a reassuring smile, so Sam nodded to Ava, then to Eli. Both nodded back, their jaws clenched as they clung to one another. Their clothes were stiff with newness, the creases from hangers and folds pronounced on their arms and shoulders. The first thing they had asked Sam after establishing Kelly's disposition was when they would be able to return to their home. Sam had been unable to provide a definitive answer. The Wilsons took the lack of information with a type of resignation that seemed ingrained in their souls. They were clearly part of that forgotten swath of poor, rural people. They were accustomed to waiting for the system to play out, usually not in their favor. The hollowed looks in their eyes reminded Sam of the images of refugees in magazines. Perhaps there were parallels. Ava and Eli Wilson were completely lost. Forced into an unfamiliar world, their sense of safety, Their sense of peace, everything that they cherished from their life before, was gone. Sam reminded herself that Lucy Alexander and Douglas Pinkman were gone, too. Lenore leaned over and whispered something to Ava. The woman nodded. Sam noted the time. The hearing was about to begin. Kelly Wilson's entrance was announced by the distant jingle of chains, as if Santa Claus and his sleigh were on the other side of the wall. The bailiff opened the door, cameras clicked, murmurs filled the courtroom. Kelly was ushered in by four armed guards, each of them so large that the girl was lost in a sea of flesh. She was reduced to shuffling her feet because they had put her in four-point restraints. The guard on the right held her by the arm, his fingers overlapped. The man was so muscular, he could have picked up Kelly one-handed and placed her in the chair. Sam was glad that he was standing beside Kelly. The moment the girl saw her parents, her knees gave out. The guard kept her from falling to the floor. Kelly began to wail.
"Mama!"
She tried to reach out, but her hands were chained to her waist.
"Daddy!"
she yelled.
"Please!"
Sam was up and across the room before she could think about how she managed to move so quickly. She grabbed Kelly's hands. "Look at me." The girl would not look away from her parents.
"Mama, I'm so sorry."
Sam squeezed Kelly's hands harder, just enough to cause pain. "Look at me," she demanded. Kelly looked at Sam. Her face was wet with tears. Her nose was running. Her teeth chattered. "I'm here," Sam said, holding firm to her hands. "You're okay. Keep looking at me."
"We all right?"
the bailiff asked. He was an older man, but the hand resting on the butt of his taser was steady. Sam said, "Yes, we're all right." The guards unlocked the chains from Kelly's ankles, her wrists, her waist.
"I can't do this,"
Kelly whispered. "You're okay," Sam insisted, willing her to be so. "Remember how we talked about people watching you?" Kelly nodded. She used her sleeve to wipe her nose, holding firm to Sam's hands. Sam said, "You need to be strong. Don't upset your parents. They want you to be a big girl, all right?" Kelly nodded again.
"Yes, ma'am."
"You're okay," Sam repeated. The chains hit the floor. One of the guards leaned down and gathered them in one hand. Sam leaned into the girl's shoulder as they walked to the table. Sam sat down. The guard pushed Kelly down into the chair beside her. Kelly looked back at her parents.
"I'm okay,"
she told them, her voice quivering.
"I'm okay."
The door opened to the judge's chamber. The court clerk said,
"All rise for Judge Stanley Lyman."
Sam nodded to Kelly, indicating that she should stand. As the judge walked to the bench, Kelly grabbed Sam's hand again. Her palms were soaked with sweat. Stan Lyman appeared to be Rusty's age, absent the avuncular spring in his step. Judges were a varied breed. Some were confident enough to simply take their place at the bench. Others sought to establish their dominance the moment they entered the courtroom. Stan Lyman fell into the latter category. He scowled as he scanned the gallery, the overflowing prosecution table. His gaze stopped on Sam. He performed an almost mechanical assessment of every section of her body, as if processing her through an MRI. She had not been so thoroughly inspected by a man since her last physical. He banged his gavel, his eyes still on Sam.
"Be seated."
Sam sat, pulling Kelly down beside her. The unwelcome butterflies returned. She wondered if Charlie was watching from the gallery. The clerk announced,
"This is case number OA-15-925, Dickinson County versus Kelly Renee Wilson for arraignment."
She returned to Ken Coyne.
"Counsel, please state your name for the record."
Coyne stood and addressed the judge.
"Good afternoon, Your Honor. Kenneth C. Coyne, Darren Nickleby, Eugene Cotton Henderson, and Kaylee Collins for the county."
Lyman gave a stern nod.
"Good afternoon."
Sam stood again. Your Honor, Samantha Quinn for Miss Wilson, who is present.
Afternoon. Lyman nodded again. This arraignment will qualify as a probable cause hearing. Miss Quinn, if you and Miss Wilson will stand for arraignment.
Sam nodded for Kelly to stand beside her. The girl was shaking again. Sam did not hold her hand. Kelly would be in and out of courtrooms for the next several years. She needed to learn to stand on her own.
Miss Quinn,
Lyman stared down at Sam from the bench. He had gone off script.
You will remove those sunglasses in my courtroom.
Sam was momentarily bewildered by the request. Her lenses had been darkened for so many years that she hardly remembered. Your Honor, these are my prescription glasses. They're tinted for a medical condition.
Come up here.
He waved her to the bench.
Let me see them.
Sam felt the mad thumping of her heart in her chest. 100 sets of eyes were on her back. Cameras were clicking. Reporters were noting every word. Ken Coyne coughed into his hand again but said nothing to vouch for her. Sam left her cane in her purse. She burned with humiliation as she limped toward the judge. The cameras sounded like dozens of grasshoppers rubbing together their legs. The images they captured would be printed in newspapers, perhaps shown online where Sam's colleagues would see them. The stories that accompanied the photos would likely delve into why she needed her glasses. The locals in the gallery, the ones who had been around for years, would gladly provide the details. They were scrutinizing Sam's gait, trying to see how much damage the bullet had done. She was a veritable freak at the circus sideshow. At the bench, Sam's hand trembled as she removed her glasses. The harsh fluorescent light stabbed into her corneas. She told the judge, "Please be careful with them. I didn't bring a spare." Lyman took the glasses, roughly, then held them up for inspection.
"Were you not told to dress appropriately for my courtroom?"
Sam looked down at her outfit, the same variation on the black silk blouse and flowing black pants she wore every day.
"I beg your pardon?"
"What are you wearing?"
"Armani," she told the judge. "May I have my glasses returned, please?" He placed them on the bench with a hard tap.
"You may take your place."
Sam checked the lenses for smudges. She slipped on the glasses. She turned back around. She searched for Charlie in the crowd, but all she could see were the vaguely familiar faces, older now, of people she recognized from her childhood. The walk back was longer than the walk to the bench. She reached out for the table. At the last minute, she saw Ben sitting in the gallery directly behind Ken Coyne. He winked at her, smiling his encouragement. Kelly took Sam's hand as they stood together. She repeated Sam's encouragement back to her.
"You're okay."
"I am, thank you." Sam let the girl hold her hand. She was too rattled to do otherwise. Judge Lyman cleared his throat a few times. That he had seemingly realized the hell he'd put Sam through came as no consolation. She knew from experience that some judges covered their mistakes by punishing the lawyer from whom it had been elicited. He said,
"Miss Quinn, do you waive the full reading of the charges against Miss Wilson?"
Sam was tempted to tell him no, but the departure from the norm would only drag out the proceedings. "We do." Lyman nodded to the clerk.
"You may arraign Miss Wilson and advise her of her rights."
The clerk stood up again.
"Kelly Renee Wilson, you have been arrested on probable cause for 2 counts of murder in the first degree. Miss Quinn, are you prepared to enter a plea?"
Sam said, "We would ask the court to enter the plea of not guilty." There came a titter of shock from the ill-informed crowd. Lyman lifted up his gavel, but the noise died off before he brought it down.
The clerk said, "A not guilty plea is entered on behalf of the defendant to all counts."
The woman turned to Kelly. Sam thought there was something familiar about her round face. Another schoolmate, long forgotten. She had not spoken up for Sam when the judge had demanded her glasses either.
The clerk said, "Kelly Renee Wilson, you have a right to a public speedy trial by jury. You have a right to counsel. You have a right against self-incrimination. These rights abide and stay with you throughout the proceeding. Thank you.
Lyman lowered his hand. Sam told Kelly to sit. The judge said,
The first issue for me is, Mr. Coyne, do you believe there will be a superseding indictment subsequent to convening a grand jury?
Sam made a note in her pad as King Coyne shuffled to the podium. Another one of his cheap tricks, trying to establish dominance. As with a child, the best thing to do was ignore him.
Your Honor, Coyne leaned his elbows on the podium. There is a definite possibility.
Lyman asked,
Do you have a timetable?
Not definitely, Your Honor. Ballpark for convening is within the next 2 weeks.
Thank you. Mr. Prosecutor, you may step back to the table.
Lyman was an older judge. He knew the games lawyers played.
And the disposition of the defendant pending trial?
Coyne took his place behind the table as he addressed the judge.
We will hold the defendant either at the city or county jail, whichever is deemed the safest place for her. Miss Quinn?
The judge asked. Sam knew there was no chance that Kelly Wilson would be given bail. She said,
I have no objection to the disposition at this time, Your Honor. Though, as to a previous matter, I would like to waive the right of Miss Wilson to have the charges heard by a grand jury.
Kelly was already facing a probable cause finding for 2 counts of first-degree murder. Sam didn't want to open her up to further charges by convening a grand jury. My client has no wish to slow down the process.
Very well.
Lyman made another note.
Mr. Coyne, is it your intention to treat this as an open discovery case, meaning you will turn over evidence and such and not hold anything back?
Coyne held out his hands, a disciple to Christ.
Always, Your Honor. Unless there is some legal basis, open discovery has always been this office's policy.
Sam felt her nostrils flare. She reminded herself that the hospital tape would be Rusty's fight.
Lyman asked, Are you satisfied with that, Miss Quinn?
I am for the moment, Your Honor. I am serving as co-counsel today. My father will be filing motions with the court as soon as he is able.
Lyman put down his pen. For the first time, he looked at her without disapproval.
How is your father?
Eager to mount a vigorous defense for Miss Wilson, Your Honor.
Lyman twisted his lips to the side, clearly unsure of her tone.
Are you aware that this is a capital murder case, Miss Quinn? Which means the prosecution may well seek the death penalty, as is its right?
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
I'm unfamiliar with the customs where you're from, Miss Quinn, but down here we take our capital cases very seriously.
I'm from Winder Road, about 6 miles up the street, Your Honor. I am aware of the seriousness of these charges.
Lyman clearly did not like the giggles in the gallery. He asked Sam,
Why do I feel that you are not really operating in the capacity of co-counsel to your father?
He gestured broadly with his hand.
In other words, you have no intention of continuing your work through to the trial.
I believe you put Mr. Grail in a similar position, Your Honor, but I assure you I am engaged in this case and intend to fully support Miss Wilson in any capacity that is required of me in aid of her defense.
All right.
He smiled, and Sam felt her blood run cold. Because she had walked right into his trap.
Do you have any question or doubt in your mind about the defendant's ability to assist you or understand the nature of these proceedings?
I'm not raising that issue at this time, Your Honor.
Lyman would not let her off so easily.
Let's humor ourselves, Miss Quinn. Should you, as co-counsel, raise the issue in the future,
I would only do so on the basis of any scientific testing, Your Honor.
Scientific testing?
He looked askance.
Sam said, Miss Wilson has exhibited a vulnerability to suggestion, Your Honor, as I am certain the prosecution can confirm.
Coyne jumped in. Your Honor, I cannot.
Sam talked over him. Miss Wilson's verbal intellectual range is narrow for an 18-year-old.
I would like to have assessed her memory encoding for visual nonverbal communication, language functioning, any deficiencies in word and encoded information retrieval, and to quantify her emotional and intellectual quotient. Coyne huffed a laugh.
And you expect the county to pay for all that?
Sam turned to look at him. I was told you take your capital cases seriously down here. There was a bubble of laughter from the crowd. Lyman banged his gavel several times before they settled. Sam caught the slight lift of the corners of his mouth as he suppressed a smile. Judges rarely enjoyed themselves in the courtroom. This man had been on the bench so long that he likely thought he had seen everything. Your Honor, Sam said, testing the waters. If I may raise another issue. He gave her an overly generous nod to illustrate the latitude he was allowing.
Why not?
Thank you, Your Honor, Sam said. Miss Wilson's parents are eager to return to their home. A timeline from the prosecution as to when they expect to release the Wilson home would be welcomed. Ken Coyne jumped up from the table again.
Your Honor, as yet the county does not have an estimate for the completion of said search of the Wilson abode.
He seemed to realize he could not match Sam's formalized language. He flashed his teeth at the judge.
These things are very hard to predict, Judge. We need time for a thorough search, properly performed under the guidelines put forth in the warrant.
Sam kicked herself for not reading the warrant ahead of time.
Lyman said, There is your answer, Miss Quinn, such as it is.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sam watched him pick up the gavel. She mulled the judge's such as it is in her mind. She felt a rush of certainty, her instinct urging her that now was the time.
Your Honor, Lyman again laid down his gavel. Miss Quinn,
as to discovery,
I believe that has been addressed.
I understand that, Your Honor. However, there was a video recording made of Miss Wilson yesterday afternoon while she was being detained at the hospital.
Your Honor,
Coyne was on his feet again.
Detained?
In custody, Sam clarified.
Oh, come on.
Coyne's tone dripped with disgust. You can't, Your Honor. Lyman held up his hand to stop them both. He sat back in his chair. He steepled together his fingers in thought. These moments happened often in the courtroom, where the judge stopped the proceedings to think through the intricacies of a request. Most times, they ended up kicking the problem down the road. Asked for motions to be written, or simply said they would delay their decision to another time. Sometimes they threw the question back to the attorneys, which meant that you had to be prepared to succinctly argue the merits or run the risk of prejudicing the judge against your position for the remainder of the case. Sam tensed, feeling as if she was locked into the starting block, staring down the open track. Lyman had mentioned discovery very early on, so he likely knew that Ken Coyne was prepared to follow the letter, not the spirit of the law. Lyman gave Sam the nod. She took off. Miss Wilson was in the custody of a plainclothes police officer who accompanied her from the middle school to the hospital. He was in the ambulance with her. He stayed with her in her hospital room through the night. He rode with Miss Wilson in the police car that took her to the jail this morning, and he was present when she was Mirandized this morning. If I use the words detained or in custody, that is because any reasonable person...
Your Honor, Ken said. Is this an arraignment or a special episode of How to Get Away with Murder?
Lyman gave Sam a flinty look, but he also gave her more leeway.
Miss Quinn,
pursuant to the prosecutor's stated position on open discovery... We request a copy of the hospital video be turned over to Miss Wilson post-haste so that she can evaluate how to proceed.
How to proceed?
Coyne echoed as if the notion was ludicrous.
What Kelly Wilson said was, Mr. Coyne!
Lyman's voice was raised loudly enough to project to the back of the room. He cleared his throat in the silence. He told Coyne,
I would consider your words very carefully.
Coyne demurred.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Lyman picked up his pen. He turned the barrel slowly, a stalling measure that was meant to further rebuke Coyne. Even Kelly Wilson knew that you did not present evidence at an arraignment. Lyman asked,
Mr. Coyne, when can a copy of this hospital video be made available?
Coyne said, We'll have to have the film converted, sir. It was made on an iPhone belonging to Sheriff Keith Coyne.
Your Honor? Sam felt her teeth grit.